Home prices are still falling.
They're now at their lowest levels since the housing market collapsed.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, February 22nd.
Coming up, the turmoil in Libya has sent oil prices to 2.5-year highs. Also, how much does the military spend on each soldier serving in Afghanistan? And what's the most livable city in the U.S.? The answer may surprise you. Those stories and more are just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
What does Tier 1 capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Starting out today, looks like things are getting worse in the housing market. A closely watched index out this morning says home prices in 11 major U.S. cities have fallen to their lowest levels since the housing bubble popped. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index of Home Prices fell in December from November in all but one of the 20 cities tracked by the report. On top of that, there's word that some of the banks that most aggressively sold subprime mortgage loans may soon see civil litigation from federal regulators. Former executives of failed Washington Mutual Bank could be next in line to face litigation from the FDIC. Christopher Whalen from Institutional Risk Analytics says more suits will follow this one.
There's still 800 banks on the troubled list. If half of those fail, I would guess at least half of the failed banks will see litigation by the FDIC against the officers and directors.
Whalen expects the four biggest banks to receive federal help. Citibank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and J.P. Morgan could be next. Oh, and the housing market? The only metro area to see a gain in those December home prices was Washington. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Lots of interesting corporate earnings today. Walmart said this morning that sales rose at its overseas stores, which have seen a lot of growth, but they dropped here in the United States, which still accounts for more than 60% of Walmart's business. Also, Home Depot said sales were up as Americans start doing more home improvements.
Well, Hewlett-Packard will report after the market closes today. Last summer, the company was caught in the middle of a sexual harassment scandal that forced the resignation of CEO Mark Hurd. With a look at how the company is faring under its new leader, Leo Apotheker, here's reporter Sally Herships.
Many analysts expect HP to post strong results today, but Crawford Del Pret with IDC says Leo Apotheker can't take all the credit.
He deserves the credit for keeping the team stable, but really, it's not as if we saw major changes in the strategy over the last quarter.
Instead, Del Pret says it's the staff Apotheker inherited.
That management team had their boss leave in a big transition and continued to execute really, really well.
Del Pret says the team has overseen development of new products like a touchpad tablet due out this summer. Apotheker is the former CEO of software maker SAP, and he wants HP, a company still better known for printers, to focus more on software.
They're not known for this.
Shane Greenstein teaches technology industry management at Northwestern University.
So a big question for anybody who watches them is whether they're going to be successful at doing that.
Like most other tech companies these days, HP wants to take on Apple's iPad. And Greenstein says HP hopes having its own hardware and software will be an advantage. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It is Election Day in Chicago. Residents there are voting for a mayor to replace Richard Daley, who's held the office since 1989. One of the issues in the race is a rule that's been on the books for decades. It requires anyone who works for the city to live in the city. Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold reports.
The six candidates running for mayor have found few positions to agree on, and Chicago's requirement that its 35,000 police, fire, and other workers live in the city is no different. Outgoing mayor Richard Daley has argued that without the requirement, those workers would live in the suburbs, thereby not pay city taxes and do their shopping outside Chicago.
If you go to Detroit, you go to Cleveland, you go to Philadelphia,
talk to all those mayors, they'll tell you. They lost all their middle class.
Some of the current mayoral candidates have said they'd consider waiving the residency requirement as part of contract negotiations with city unions. Dawn Clark Netch teaches municipal law at Northwestern University. She says even if the requirement is ditched, it's not going to necessarily mean an exodus of city workers.
In this economy, I mean, how many people are going to pack up and they can't sell their house anyway probably right now and move just because the residency requirement is abandoned? It allows them to do that.
Netsch says it's old Chicago lore that city workers live in neighborhoods right on the edge of the city limits. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, February 22nd. I'm Steve Giatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. Well, the oil company Shell has moved all of its foreign workers out of Libya following a similar move by BP. And the instability in Libya, which is a major oil-producing nation, continues to sink global markets. We'll get to the numbers in a bit with our regular Tuesday analyst. But first, let's bring in Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So tell us why investors are so concerned about what's going on right now in Libya.
Well, as you say, Libya is a big oil and gas producer, up to 2 million barrels a day. And the fear is that there may be not just a temporary interruption in that flow of oil and gas. The worry is that a new government might come to power in Libya, which is very nationalistic, and might kick out Western oil companies, and that could lead to a longer-lasting fall in supply, and that could push oil prices even higher.
And Stephen, at what point do we have to worry about higher oil prices actually slowing down the global economic recovery?
Well, not yet, but there's a cumulative effect here. We've had a whole series of supposedly temporary hikes in the price of oil and other commodities. And economists are worrying that there'll come a point when companies will decide these are not temporary after all, and they'll push up their prices to cover their costs. Here's Professor Dominic Swords of the Henley Business School.
The longer and the more spikes and temporary blips we have, I think our worry is that the expectations of continued inflation of commodity prices as well as oil prices gets built into the system.
And he says there'll come a point in the not too distant future, perhaps, when central banks will have to take notice and have to curb that inflation by pushing up the cost of borrowing. And that's when the economic recovery will be in greatest danger.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
Let's get a little more perspective and dig deeper into how long the economic repercussions will last. The BBC's Chloe Arnold is with us from Algiers, Algeria this morning. Hello, Chloe.
Hello, Steve.
Is there any suggestion right now that oil production could be hit permanently because of what's going on in Libya?
I don't think people are getting too many jitters just yet because, of course, if they do need to increase capacity, OPEC is in a position to do that. They can simply ask, for example, the Saudi Arabians to turn on the oil taps and increase capacity. But certainly, if this situation continues, then there are going to be concerns over what might happen generally to oil production.
Apart from oil and gas, what other industries contribute to the economy of the region there?
Very little, I have to say. Libya and Algeria, which is, of course, where I am, are primarily exporters of oil and gas. There's a tiny amount of date production and a very, very small amount of fisheries as well. I think they export river eel to the European Union. But if we talk about other countries in the region, Morocco, Tunisia and Egypt, there is an enormous tourism industry. And there's great concern, I think, that tourists are just very reluctant to come back. For those countries, there will be concerns for the economy.
The BBC's Chloe Arnold with us from Algiers. Chloe, thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Goodbye.
Well, U.S. crude is up almost $7 this morning at about $96 a barrel. That's a 2.5-year high. Julie Neiman is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She joins us now, as she does every Tuesday, from St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So it seems like oil markets were relaxing a little bit after Egypt's regime collapsed. Why is what's happening in Libya so concerning?
Well, the markets have been blowing off their revolts today. Another day, another despot down. But you're looking at this one is an OPEC producer. About 2 million barrels a day on average is what they've been producing, which is not a huge producer. But operators are shutting down and evacuating. And very slow restart time. You just don't go back in and throw on the switches again. So that production is going to be out. Now, short run, Saudi Arabia can pick it up here. There are other OPEC producers that can pick it up. But the high implication is that there's more unrest headed into the Middle East, and that's where you're seeing prices really shooting up now. Supply security is being factored in.
Okay, now, Julie, I don't usually drive because I live here in New York, but I was at the pump this weekend in the Northeast, and it was $3.21 a gallon for the cheap gas, which seemed like a lot to me. At what point will what's happening in Libya send prices at the pump here in the U.S. higher?
You're going to be seeing it immediately, simply because producers were swallowing it to some extent in terms of commodity prices. Station operators operate with a weekly load of gasoline with money from last week. They know prices are going up. They're going to have to hike their prices now to pay for what's coming because they're operating on a shoestring. So you're going to see it at the pump almost immediately.
Julie, what's the price of a gallon of gas out there in St. Louis?
Right now, we're looking at about $3 going up to $3.15, but it is headed higher, definitely. We have a lot of refineries here.
Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much.
You bet.
It's amazing how video games have changed over the years. Jeremy, you play video games, don't you? You're a gamer, aren't you?
Yeah. Occasionally. I play the little games on my iPhone.
There you go. All right.
Angry Birds.
A lot of people love the Angry Birds. Well, this, of course, is what I used to play when I was a kid. The Smithsonian Museum in Washington is going to choose from hundreds of games, including earlier games such as Pac-Man and more recent ones, Halo 2, for example, for an exhibit it's going to put together next year. Video games as artistic medium. So can you just hear it now, these art critics going, I think that Space Invaders has such color and texture. I don't know what they're going to say, but it's going to be interesting, and the exhibit is next year. I think it starts in March of next year. So you can vote, by the way, for which games should be included in that exhibit. We have a link to that at our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, the 22nd of February. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles and on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson. You can also give us your feedback by going to marketplace.org and clicking on the link that says contact. Or, Steve, you can go to our Facebook page and like APM Marketplace.
In France, the fishing economy has taken a big hit after fishermen there began striking over a European-wide ban limiting the export of eels. Christopher Worth reports now the species is harder to catch these days because there aren't a lot of eels left.
A good place to begin this story is here, at this old traditional jellied eel shop in London's East End, where owner Bob Cook is dishing out my first ever bowl of stewed eels.
There's your eels there.
I couldn't bring myself to order the jellied ones. They just looked too slimy.
Parsley sauce. How's that for you?
Eels used to be a cheap, popular dish among London's working poor, but these days, Cook's shop is usually empty.
Look at the time. 12:15. You're my first customer.
Today, the demand for eels comes from aquaculture farms in China, where a pound of live baby eels from Europe can fetch as much as $500. Lucrative for fishermen, but worrying for conservationists like Heidi Stone of the UK's Environment Agency. She says the number of baby eels returning from the open seas has dropped over 90%, and no one is sure why.
It's not one thing. It's going to be a combination of factors. Climate change, overfishing, lack of habitat.
As a result, the European Union banned the export of eels last year. That meant fishermen in France, where most eel fishing takes place, were making a lot less money, and they weren't happy about it. But here at one of the last remaining eel fisheries in the UK, owner Peter Wood is happy the ban is in place.
This fishery has been very good to the people working in it, and we need to make sure that it's available for future generations.
Most of his eels go towards restocking Europe's depleted waterways, but he says the demand from China has driven up the cost of eels and that kind of restoration.
It is simply just been a take process to Asia.
Here in Europe, the EU lifted the ban for a few months last year under pressure from the French fishing industry. Now the ban is back in place. Wood says this time he hopes it sticks. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Okay, it's quiz time now here at the Marketplace Midday Update. And our quiz master, Stefan Richter of theglobalist.com, joins us now from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Jeremy. Are you ready for today's quiz?
I am ready.
Okay, this one is in the context of all the budget debates and what costs money in the United States and for U.S. taxpayers. So my question for you today is this. How much does it cost per year to support one U.S. service member deployed in Afghanistan? Mm. Is it A, $67,000 a year, B, $132,000 a year, C, a staggering $685,000 per year, or D, an unbelievable $1.2 million a year?
Well, I am going to guess that it is on the higher end of things, but I will just go with $600,000 a year and not $1.2 million.
Not quite. This number would be right for the war in Iraq, according to numbers from the Washington-based Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Uh-huh. $685,000, that's, by the way, over 10 times more than the cost of a soldier deployed in World War II. So these wars are getting more expensive all the time.
All right, so I'll guess the $1.2
million. $1.2 million per year. Of course, the least of that is wages or salary for the soldiers themselves. Most of it is due to the sheer lack of infrastructure in Afghanistan, its geographical position as a landlocked nation. And the biggest single item in this? Fuel costs.
Wow.
Per troop deployed, $200,000 to $350,000 a year. Just in fuel costs. With all this heavy stuff that's coming in now, that number is probably going to go up as the oil prices are going up.
All right, Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief at The Globalist. You can find out more about the world at theglobalist.com. Thanks again, Stefan.
Good to be with you today.
All right, now a quiz for you, Steve.
Uh-oh.
What is the most livable city in the United States?
Oh, boy. Gary, Indiana, my hometown.
It's not Gary, Indiana.
Okay.
It is Pittsburgh. That's according to the Economist Intelligence
Another steel
unit.
Town, you see?
Another steel town.
Yes.
The Rust Belt is now the Must Belt. It's based on everything from culture and education to safety and infrastructure. Honolulu, by the way, is number two in the United States after Pittsburgh.
Nice. That's nice.
But get this, not a single U.S. city made the top 25 most livable cities in the world.
Ooh.
Not a single one.
Wow.
Apparently, Canada and Australia are where it's
well,
at, according to The Economist.
Wow.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, you can see where other cities are ranked at marketplace.org. I know, Steve, that Los Angeles did beat New York in this survey.
Well,
the
of
most
course.
Livable.
I mean, come on.
New York.
Come on. What's the temperature over there right now? What
it's
is like, it
like? I don't know, 25 degrees,
oh,
something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's 52 and mostly sunny here in L.A.
Well, blah-dee-da. All right. Well, in New York, which is number 53, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in L.A., I'm Steve Chiatakis. Enjoy your Tuesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.